This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is writer and journalist Dan Coppell. Dan is author of the book To See Every Bird on Earth, is a contributing editor at National Geographic Adventure, and has been featured in Popular Science, The New York Times Magazine, Bicycling, Mountain Bicycling, Wired, and Audubon magazines, among others. Dan Coppell is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, published in 2008 by Hudson Street Press. Welcome, Dan.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
What led you to write a book about bananas?
Well, what initially got me interested was I had a magazine assignment to write about bananas, and I went down to Honduras and found out about this disease that was hitting the banana crop. It was a short magazine article, and I learned so much more than the magazine article allowed me to write. I learned about the culture of bananas, the history of bananas, not just this banana disease, but about this 7,000-year history of the world's most popular and important fruit. I became obsessed, so obsessed that I realized that I'd better write a book.
How important a role do bananas play as a source of food for humans?
Bananas were the first cultivated fruit. They are the fourth most important food crop in the world, the number one fruit. In Africa, just to give you an example, some parts of Africa, bananas account for 80% of the caloric intake for many people. In Uganda, for example, 900 pounds a year of bananas are consumed by some people. That 900 pounds, now we Americans eat 25 pounds of bananas a year. So if you lose bananas in Africa, people starve. Bananas are important all over the world, in Asia. Wherever bananas are grown, they are a major, major part of the diet.
How many different kinds of bananas are currently eaten, and what are they like?
Well, it's interesting because here in the U.S., we find basically one banana, and most people think there's one banana, but in fact, there are over 1,000 different kinds of bananas. There are bananas that are small. There are bananas that are twice as big as ours. There are bananas that are red. There are bananas that are as thick as your arm. There are bananas that have as much vitamin A as a carrot. And there are bananas that taste like apples. You know, these 1,000 bananas, they can all taste different, and they're wonderful and strange. There's an African banana whose variety name is Mongo Love. In India, they write poems about bananas. So it's a marvelous and fascinating world. It's an amazing fruit. Unfortunately, we only have this one banana that we eat, so a lot of people don't know that.
How are bananas grown?
One thing that's very interesting about bananas is even though they grow 30 feet high. A banana is actually not a tree. It's an herb. It's the world's largest herb. Bananas are seedless, so they are grown basically through cuttings. One banana tree, basically you take a more or less a cutting from it and put it in the ground, and another one grows. And this is what makes it such an important foodstuff in the third world. You can grow a banana tree in a Ugandan village, and you keep cutting from what's called the mother plant to the daughter plant, and you can feed your family for many generations from one original plant. And that makes it so important because it goes on and on and on. And in that sense, bananas are very easy to raise. And that is why 7,000 years ago, when people emerged from their hunter-gatherer lives in the jungles, they emerged with bananas. And bananas were part of the reason we organized into these communities and formed agriculture.
Would you give a brief overview of how the banana industry and the industrialized world came to be?
Yeah, it's an overview that contains both sort of miracles and tragedy. The banana is a fruit that really shouldn't be on our shelves. Less than 150 years ago, Americans had never heard of the banana. It was a tropical fruit. Those who had heard of it, it was a sort of a weird exotic. It was impossible to bring bananas to the U.S. because bananas rot very easily. You know, 10 days off a tree, a banana's no good. And it took longer than 10 days to get a banana to the U.S. You know, bananas still today have to be shipped under refrigeration. They're fragile. And there were a couple of entrepreneurs who had the idea that they were going to find a way to bring bananas to America. But Americans didn't know what bananas were. There was no technology to bring them cold to Americans. So these men had to figure out ways to do this. They had to figure out ways to grow bananas. And they had to figure out ways to get bananas under all this pressure cheaply. They had a tropical fruit, needed to be refrigerated, needed to be shipped fast, needed to be cheaper than something like apples, which were grown close by. And this was sort of an impossible equation, and they managed to convince Americans what bananas were. They managed to make Americans fall in love with bananas. They managed to solve the shipping problems. Unfortunately, to do this, they needed to do some pretty terrible things overseas. To keep bananas cheap, to compensate for how much it cost to ship them, they had to get a lot of land in Central and South America, and they had to get a lot of cheap labor. And to do this, they really had to take over countries. They couldn't afford to pay for land. They couldn't afford to pay for labor. And when you can't afford to pay for land or pay for labor, you have to take it. And to take it, they needed military power. They needed to use very brutal tactics. They killed, they maimed, they stole. And when a country resisted, when people resisted, there was no hesitation to draw blood, to use the U.S. Army to intervene. This happened over and over again, starting around 1900, and it went on through the 1950s. This was the price of our cheap bananas, which quickly became America's favorite fruit, which remains today. And these countries that were taken over by U.S. banana companies became known as the Banana Republics. And this is where we get our term today. It's not just a clothing store, and I find that name for the clothing store, if not offensive, then certainly ironic. It's a bloody history for what is a very sort of friendly, lovable fruit.
Could you say more and give some specific examples of how the banana industry affected the countries in which it operated?
Sure, I'll give you three examples if you'd like, and I'll start with one that's both sad and, you know, I could even say amusing, because it's the beginning and it just kind of shows the smaller scale at which it started, and then I'll go on to give you some that just show how it exploded into horror. One of the very earliest times it happened was in Honduras. A fellow named Sam Zamuri was a little annoyed that he was unable to grow his bananas freely in Honduras. So he decided that, well, the Honduran government was not doing what he wanted. So he went off with a bunch of buddies. One of them was named Machine Gun Maloney, and he was being followed by some government agents who were a little suspicious of what he might be doing. This was in New Orleans. And so he hid out in a brothel in New Orleans. The government agents waited for him at the door, and he slipped out through the back with his cronies. They headed off into a boat, spent a few days getting down to Honduras, and raised a few troops, and within a few days they'd taken over the government and they had their banana lands as they wanted. And, you know, it's a colorful story. Machine Gun Maloney and another guy was named Lee Christmas. They shot up a few people, and it was a small scale, still terrible. Well, Sam Zamuri went on to become the CEO of a company called United Fruit, which is now known as Chiquita. 1929, United Fruit also is now embroiled in a strike in Colombia. The banana workers are on strike. They're wanting health care. They're wanting many of the things that people strike for and workers ask for today. They've gathered in the town square in a small village. It's a Sunday. They've just come out of church. They're with their wives and children, and they're about to listen to a speech. The town square is surrounded by buildings, and at the rooftops of the buildings are army troops, Colombian army troops, who have been ordered there, and this is documented by telegrams that were sent between the U.S. ambassador to Colombia and United Fruit's representatives, who are waiting there with machine guns. And as the workers gather, they are all massacred, men, women, and children. Their bodies are thrown into the ocean. Any of your listeners who have read the Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel, 100 Years of Solitude, know this story. It was fictionalized in that book, and most of them don't know that the banana massacre, that's the climax of that book, was an actual real story. And then it escalates even more. The most terrible and sad example of this was 1954, the government of Guatemala, the very first truly democratically elected government in Central America. The president was Jacobo Arbenz, and he was elected on a platform of agrarian reform. He wanted to return some of the banana lands that had been sold for pennies an acre to, again, United Fruit, Chiquita, to the workers. He wanted fairness for his workers. He wanted to make a fair bargain with Chiquita. He wanted to allow them to continue to grow very cheaply. He didn't want major workers' rights. He wanted to go very slowly because he knew the history, over 20 overthrows at that point in his region. And with the help of the U.S. government and the CIA, again, this is all documented information that's come out, he was overthrown and forced to leave the country. And that began 30 years of destabilization of the Guatemalan government that resulted in the genocide of hundreds of thousands of native Mayan people and anyone in Guatemala who was considered to have left-wing leanings after the right-wing government was installed to replace Arbenz by the people who were sponsored by the U.S. military. And so over and over again, you see the attempts to control the banana industry, attempts to bring this fruit that we slice into our cornflakes, creating horror. And the reason, again, is that even today, if you go to your market there in Seattle, you'll see bananas for 59, 69 cents a pound. And your listeners, you know, don't even necessarily think about that, but they look at the local apples, which are grown in Washington State, and they cost $1 a pound or $1.29 a pound. And you need to wonder, how is that? How is it that these bananas, which come from Peru or Ecuador or Guatemala, how is it that they cost half the price? And the reason is these huge economies of scale. And even today, although there aren't massacres and uprisings, even today, banana workers are paid far less even than the migrant laborers who might pick those apples. And so you look at that bloody history of bananas, and it's all about keeping it cheap. And that was what those massacres were about. There couldn't even be a hint of dissent in the banana world. And again, you know, you in Seattle, you're as close to apple land as possible, and, you know, it's something to think about. Why are those bananas half the price when they're grown thousands of miles away? That's the story.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Dan Capel, author of the book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What have been some environmental consequences of the mass production of bananas?
Well, in order to grow bananas, you need a lot of land. And the biggest environmental consequence, besides, you know, the destruction of rainforest and things like that, which I wouldn't say is specific to bananas, anything you grow down there requires that, is to the banana itself. Bananas are, we eat one banana. It's called the Cavendish banana. And what's interesting about that is that it's not the banana that these original banana barons that we talked about grew. It's not the banana that was introduced to the United States. That banana was a different breed. It's called the Gros Michel banana. That banana was introduced, and it actually was a better tasting banana than the one that we eat today. It was also a hardier banana. It ripened more slowly. It was tougher. It didn't bruise as well. The problem was that, like the banana we eat today, it was a monoculture. And that means that there was only one, and every banana that was grown, just like every banana today that's grown, was an identical twin to every other one. They're clones. And so each banana is susceptible to the same diseases as another. And so when a banana gets sick, every banana can get sick. Well, almost as soon as the Gros Michel was introduced, a disease arrived called Panama disease. And this disease spread like wildfire through the banana crop. And once it hit a banana plantation, that plantation was ruined forever. It could no longer grow bananas. The disease was in the soil, and it was stuck there. And so what happened was the banana industry had to abandon plantations. The New York Times, in about 1910, referred to these very first abandoned plantations as leper colonies. And just a few years earlier, the Los Angeles Times had referred to these very same plantations as gold mines. And so you got into this cycle of growth and then abandonment of plantations. And so over and over again, the banana companies are abandoning rainforests, former rainforests that they just cut down. Now, of course, I just talked about the need to keep bananas cheap and take land. This makes that even worse because they need more and more land. But more importantly, they're just environmentally devastating all of Latin America by tearing stuff down, and they're being chased by this disease. And this is because of the monoculture. There's only one banana that's being relied on, and so there's no alternative. There's no other banana to grow that that might resist the disease. When you look at apples, for example, there's 7, 8, 9, 10 different kinds. If one apple gets sick, then, you know, the other 8 or 9 might not. And this is the bane of the banana industry's existence. And in fact, with this Gros Michel banana, the first banana, by about 1960, it's game over. The disease has spread everywhere. That banana is basically extinct. And the Cavendish banana, which the banana industry has considered until then a junk banana, they consider it so bad tasting and so not hardy, they consider it too fragile to ship. They believe that American consumers will reject it as a bad banana. They've resisted changing over, is forced to change over. They do, and they have to adapt their technology. They have to put it in boxes and ship it and bag it differently, and they have to actually use all sorts of different techniques to get it to consumers. The only thing about the Cavendish that's any good is that it resists this disease, Panama disease. They can start growing it in the old abandoned plantations. And they begin to ship it, but the problem with the Cavendish is that it's also a monoculture. There's no diversity. They don't learn their lesson that they should try more than one banana. And what happened about 10 or 15 years ago is at plantations in Asia, a new version of Panama disease appeared. Not out of nowhere. It appears in the soil in Malaysia. And lo and behold, this version of Panama disease, just like a mutated version of the flu or something like that, does affect Cavendish, and it begins to spread. And now, a decade and a half or a couple of decades later, it has spread all across Asia. From Malaysia, its center of origin, it has spread into China, Pakistan, India, the Philippines, all the way to Australia, and everywhere it has gone, it has devastated Cavendish crops. It is the same thing. It has destroyed plantations, made them unusable. And there is no cure. It is a repeat of the Gros Michel crisis. It has not hit Latin America yet, and there is some question about when it will hit. Some people say 5, 10 years. Some people say 30. But there is absolutely no question that there's no cure. There's no question that there's unlikely to be a cure because people have been looking for cures for this for a long time. And there's no question that it's coming and that a crisis is coming for the banana industry. And nobody really knows what's going to happen right now, but it's most likely going to be a wipeout of the Cavendish, just as there was a wipeout of the Gros Michel.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Dan Capel, author of the book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are some potential replacements for the Cavendish?
Well, there are many great bananas out there. One that I think is fantastic is called the Lacatan banana. That is grown in the Philippines. It is a delicious banana. It's got a creamy taste, a creamy texture. It's got a taste that's much more, I'd say, banana-y than the Cavendish. It's a more intense banana flavor. It's like if you took the flavor of a whole Cavendish banana and concentrated it into half a banana. It's a really delicious banana. The Cavendish is very bland. And the banana industry knows how to grow this, knows about the banana. They reject it for a reason. The Lacatan has a red skin. They're afraid that American consumers will not know how to handle this. Imagine all our yellow bananas going away and you've got red ones instead. How will you know if it's ripe? Will people even buy it? It's a radical change in the product. Can you imagine Miss Chiquita with a red skin instead of a yellow one? There's a banana called the Goldfinger out there that was actually developed as a hybrid by Chiquita in its labs in Honduras about 20 years ago. Goldfinger also does not turn as yellow as the Cavendish. It stays somewhat green. It's also got a more tart taste and texture. It's a little apple-y, actually. That's a possible replacement, but again, it's not as sweet. So will consumers want that? It's an open question. There are other bananas out there. The problem is that, like the changeover from Gros Michel to Cavendish, all of them will require a changeover in technology. Each banana requires different kinds of shipping and ripening techniques. And so far, the banana industry has not experimented too much. In that sense, it's a repeat. They're sort of putting their heads in the sands and saying, well, we'll figure this out when it happens. We'll find a way to solve this. Maybe there'll be a cure for this disease. what really needs to be happening, you know, your program is about sustainability. What needs to be happening is not let's replace the Cavendish. Let's figure out one banana to replace it. What needs to happen is the banana industry, which I have to say invented the modern fruit industry as it is today, you know, in terms of branding, shipping, all those things, needs to get with the program and say, hey, why is it that the banana aisle in the supermarket is so pathetic? You walk into the fruit section, you see five kinds of lettuce, 10 kinds of apples, there's two kinds of cherries at least. It's a cornucopia of fruit, and that's just happened in the past 10 or 15 years. And I love bananas. I've tasted so many of them. I walk into my Safeway down here, and I just see one little banana, and it makes me sad. There are so many, and why hasn't the banana industry figured this out? We can have more than one kind of banana. American consumers are willing to say, we've got our basic 59-cent Cavendish. It's time to start experimenting with other kinds, you know, up and down to $2 a pound for other types. It's a way to help prevent disease by having a diverse crop, to buy some insurance, and to experiment with possible replacements when that day comes. And also to make people happy, because these other bananas are great. It's a win-win for everyone, and it's kind of amazing that nothing is really going on with those experiments. There's no good reason that it's not happening.
Given that bananas also have to be transported from so far away, and given the issue with global warming and fuel costs, would it be best for Americans to give up bananas?
Well, you know, I get asked that question a lot, and I don't think so, in that so many things are transported and have high fuel costs. And for me to say give up bananas and not give up plums that come from Chile during the wrong season, and not give up beef, which has a high cost, I mean, I think, and this may sound like me trying to wriggle out of the question because I'm a banana guy, and maybe it is, the whole supply chain for food, if we're just talking about food, needs to be figured out. And if bananas are part of that and the cost of bananas is far higher than everything else, then yeah, I guess so. But my suspicion is that bananas are no more or less offensive in that regard than other things that are offensive. So, you know, that may just be an excuse, but I think it needs to be looked at in terms of the cost of everything else. And bananas are the cheapest fruit, for better or worse, and I think that makes them an important staple for people who can't afford a lot of other fruit. I always point out to people that at 59 cents a pound, bananas are really important, not just because they're the cheapest fruit, but because they don't compete against other fruit in a way. Bananas compete against Snickers bars as a snack. You got to remember that. It's the cheapest thing you can get for most people that's going to compete against some really bad stuff that people eat. And that, I think, makes it worthwhile.
Earlier, you mentioned Panama disease. Would you just touch briefly on some of the other diseases that threaten bananas and also talk about their geographical distribution?
Sure. So, again, the context of this is that bananas are fundamentally a monoculture. Now, I said there are a lot of different kinds of bananas. There are about 15 kinds of bananas that are sort of the major groups that are grown around the world. So of all those kinds, they fall into some pretty major categories. And in those categories, the bananas are very susceptible to disease because they're so closely related genetically. So when bananas get sick, they get very sick and the disease is spread quickly. There's a disease called black sigatoka, which affects our commercial bananas right now. And that's a really bad disease. The difference between it and Panama disease is that sigatoka is controllable through what a lot of people, including me, would consider excessive amounts of pesticide spraying. Pesticide spraying that's really bad for banana workers and has been bad for a long time, which is why I think that people need to look at organic bananas and support purchasing them and purchase them as much as possible. So that's probably the worst banana disease worldwide. It affects African subsistence bananas as well, and has been reducing the yields of subsistence crops. And of course, subsistence farmers neither want to or can afford to spray their crops. So what they face is sort of just reduced yields. They'll grow 100 banana trees or plants and they'll get 30 that yield fruit. geographically distributed, you know, banana disease and bananas grow basically anywhere bananas can grow, which is in the tropics all around the world. Wherever the conditions are right, you'll find bananas. And wherever you find bananas, you find banana disease. The most important thing in fighting banana disease where you can't have chemicals is clean farming. And you have to teach people to not track dirt around, to keep their tools clean, and to not allow water to contaminate from one fruit to another. And this is really hard. It's especially hard in the third world, where you've got a lot of people moving back and forth by bicycle, where water supplies are not tightly controlled, where there's no filters, things like that. But it's also been really hard in conventional farming. In Australia, for example, where they've had high-tech quarantine programs that they thought could beat banana disease, like Panama disease, which arrived there fairly recently, their quarantine programs failed after they bragged pretty much that they would succeed. And this is bad news for Chiquita, which just a couple of weeks ago, the CEO of Chiquita bragged that Panama disease would not be a problem when it arrived because they had excellent quarantine programs they were beginning to develop. Quarantine has never worked, and it's not just me saying that. It's the major plant pathologists, including the one who identified the new strain of Panama disease, said that Chiquita is completely wrong-headed if it thinks that quarantine will work. It doesn't. A few drops of rain or a few clumps of dirt will spread most banana diseases pretty far, and even a few clumps of dirt is enough to get it onto a continent, and once it does, it's going to go no matter what you do.
What do you predict for the future of bananas worldwide?
Bananas will continue to thrive, and there will be bananas, but there's going to be bigger and bigger problems with bananas, and the problems will become really big. And it's going to become big enough that help is going to be needed. And thriving is going to become more of a crisis. I predict thriving because I'm hopeful that people will recognize the crisis. And it needs to be recognized in two senses. Commercially, we may see more expensive bananas. I think the Cavendish is going to be gone. I don't know when. I don't think it's going to be 5 years. I think it'll be more like 20, 25 years. I think the Cavendish will reach its dead end. I think the big issue is going to be subsistence bananas. Those diseases are coming, and it's so important to remember that people rely on bananas for their lives. We don't know that, and so we don't remember that. And there's a disconnect between the banana industry and those subsistence bananas. The bananas that people eat over there are affected by the same diseases that the bananas we eat over here are affected by, but there's no research being funded by our banana industry. Banana industry research is very poorly funded. I think there needs to be a combination of research to save the banana. Some of it needs to be genetic engineering. Some of it needs to be diversity research to get different kinds of bananas out there. So if bananas are going to thrive, those things need to happen. There has been massive effort to save wheat crops when they've been threatened, and it's worked. Potatoes were saved after the Irish potato famine. But these things only happened after crises reached major proportion. I hope that doesn't happen with bananas. But right now, it looks like it could. And so the thriving is only going to come if things go the way they are after really bad things happen. So right now it's preventable, but research has to start almost immediately, more research, because bananas take a lot of work to grow and develop and to fix, and there's not a lot of time left.
What's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message is ask for more kinds of bananas. It seems impossible to go to Whole Foods and say, give me more bananas, and to have that trickle up to the CEO of Chiquita and Dole, but learn about them. You know, just Google bananas in India, where they grow more kinds of bananas, and read about the different varieties that people eat there and get hungry. You will if you read about the descriptions of them. And if you get hungry and you start to think about it, let your stomach ask for them and find ways to demand them. And think about your apples and how delicious so many of them are, and then think about bananas that way and get them into the markets. That's the answer. Diversity. A diverse crop, and that's what's going to save the banana.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We have just been speaking with Dan Capel, author of the book Banana, The Fate of the Fruit That Changed the World, published in 2008 by the Hudson Street Press. For more information, check on the web at www.bananabook.org. Again, that's bananabook.org. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.